SBS हिंदी।
Today we are speaking to the celebrated author William Dalrymple, the author of The White Mughals, The Last Mughal, City of Jinns, and now his latest book, The Anarchy, The Relentless Rise of the East India Company. William Dalrymple. So welcome to Australia and welcome to the Hindi program, William.
Thank you so much. Dhanyawad.
Bahut shukriya aapka. Namaste. Tell me about your affinity for India, first of all.
Well, I mean, I no longer really think of it much. It's been my home since I was 18. It's just where I live, where I've made my life. I arrived aged 18, instantly fell in love with it, and never really left. I've been making a living as a writer, festival director, photographer, foreign correspondent, jack of all trades, ever since then.
Oh, wow. Is there anything that you don't like doing?
Is there anything I don't like about India, or anything I don't know, or I can't do? I mean, I'm incapable of holding down any normal kind of job. I think I'm enumerate. I can't turn up on time, but I find myself working very happily on Indian standard time.
Perfect. That sounds good. Now, and given your affinity for India, and you've lived there, you've researched there, you've written about it, have you picked up any of the languages there?
I used to speak pretty good Hindi, but to be honest, since I became a historian, I haven't used it, and it's now so rusty that I won't even shame myself by speaking it to you. So I'm going to need to go back to Missouri and really get my grammar back up and running.
All right. Give us an insight into your latest book, Anarchy. What inspired you?
So The Anarchy is really the story of the breakup of the Mughal Empire and the rise of the East India Company.
Sure.
Everyone knows how Mughal India reached its peak under Shah Jahan and then went into very rapid decline under Aurangzeb, the most bigoted and fractious of all the Mughal emperors.
Mm-hmm.
The country split up very quickly with the Marathas in the west, the Rajput states in the northwest, all the different forces that were rising up, like the Jats and the Sikhs in the Punjab and so on. And this was the period when the people that made the most of this, of the opportunities of this anarchy, of this breakup, was the two East India Companies, the French Compagnie des Indes and the English East India Company.
Right.
And they used the latest military techniques, mm-hmm, to extend their control over great swathes of India. And there'd just been a whole series of wars in Europe, the War of the Austrian Succession and the War of the Spanish Succession, which had led to great developments in warfare in Europe. And this was brought to India, this new technology of bayonets and muskets and accurate horse artillery was brought to India by the East India Companies, and they used it very quickly to first take Bengal, then to move through what's now Uttar Pradesh, and by 1803 they'd captured Delhi and more or less everything south of it, defeated the Marathas, defeated the Mughals. And people in history books are, you know, often taught this is the British in India, which is really, strictly speaking, not accurate, because it wasn't the British government. It was one company. So the East India Company is actually founded 1599. It's the time of Shakespeare. And they control right up 250 years, right until 1858.
Wow.
When it's nationalized by the British Crown.
British Crown. Yeah.
And that enormous length of time is much larger, of course, than the Raj, which only lasted 90 years from 1858 till 1947. And yet, it's the Raj we always think about when we think of the British in India. We think of Kipling and Curzon and all those guys in solar topies and khaki shorts and all the rest of it.
Right.
Or even, you know, the romanticized version of Merchant Ivory films with, you know, ladies in parasols playing croquet on similar lawns. And
eating cucumber sandwiches and lace handkerchiefs.
And actually, you know, the much longer period is this 250 years when it was one corporation based out of one London office, the East India Company. And that office was only five windows wide. It was a very modest building. 100 years into its existence, there were only 35 staff in the head office. And yet this one London office block with this skeleton staff pulled off the greatest coup in corporate history. They took over the entire Mughal Empire, which at that point was generating about a third of the world's income.
Amazing.
The GDP of India was about 37% at that point. They'd just overtaken China as the world's largest producer. But they'd become militarily and politically very vulnerable after the breakup of the Mughal Empire. And the East India Company, ruthless, militarily with the latest cutting-edge technology and backed financially by Indian bankers, particularly the Jagat Sets.
Exactly. I was just wondering how much role the Indian bankers like the Set family, Jagat Set family and other families had in breaking down the power or dethroning, for that matter, Sirajuddaula of Bengal.
Well, this was not just Sirajuddaula, but you find that right up until 1803 when the Brits do their, when the East India Company does its last big assault on the Marathas, that the different bankers are competing to lend money to the company. And the reason is that although the company was foreign in terms of religion, you know, and meat-eating and spoke different language of English, in terms of business, the East India Company and the Indian bankers understood each other. They understood the language of interest rates and commercial contracts which could be defended in English courts.
Right.
And the most difficult thing to understand in the book is why these successive Indian bankers don't just support the company, but consistently support it against other Indians.
Right. And do we have any characters running through the thread of the narrative?
Absolutely. The central character of the book is one man who is 12 years old when the book opens during the inquest of Nadir Shah in 1739.
Mm-hmm.
And then is an old man of 79 when Lord Lake marches into Delhi in 1803, and that's the Mughal Emperor Shah Alam.
Shah Alam, yes.
And Shah Alam is the opposite of his nemesis, Robert Clive.
Uh-huh.
Robert Clive is this uncivilized, brutish, extremely effective military genius who attacks from behind, attacks during fog, attacks at night, and has no trace of civilizing qualities. He doesn't describe the beauties of India in his letter. He remains completely uninterested in Indian culture. But he's an extremely effective guerrilla fighter who wins every battle that he goes into. Shah Alam, in the contrary, is this deeply civilized, charming, good-looking, good, dignified man who consistently loses. He never has the ruthlessness or the nastiness to defeat his enemies.
Mm-hmm.
And these two men are, you know, very starkly opposed in this narrative. One representing high civilization on the wane, and the other this new brutish commercial world on the rise.
Absolutely. What did the British press and parliament of that era have to say about the East India Company and the conquests they were making?
So for a long time, Britain hardly notices what's going on. India is, you know, 9 months sailing away.
Mm-hmm.
No one can visit India unless they're actually with the East India Company. They have a monopoly. So there's very little reportage about what's going on there. All people know is that people are making fortunes, and that the company is quietly paying about a third of British custom revenue. So, you know, it's an enormously valuable asset to the government who don't bother investigating very much what's going on.
Right.
And the big scandal comes when the British Parliament intervenes in 1772. That year, the company has, through sheer greed, has in a sense murdered the goose that laid the golden egg.
Ah.
There's a terrible famine in 1770.
Yes.
1 million Bengalis die.
There are
you know, hundreds of thousands of dead, dying and the sick and skeletons lying all over Calcutta. I mean, horrific scenes of utter mayhem with clouds of flies, vultures and dogs picking at human remains, disgusting and horrible nauseous smells over the whole of Bengal. These dead people, there's not enough people to bury them. And this finally is the scandal which really kind of begins the downfall of the company, because suddenly whistleblowers start writing letters to newspapers in London describing what's going on. There's a play put on in the Haymarket where Clive is lampooned as Lord Vulture.
Okay.
All this stuff finally ends up with Parliament passing a regulating act in 1774, mm-hmm. and it begins to take to take over the company. It's too valuable an asset, India, just to be managed by a corporation. And so you have this sort of intermediary period between 1774 and 1857, when I suppose the company could be called something like a public-private partnership.
Okay. Right. Now, obviously, the British chronicle their history very well. Where did you source the Indian voices from?
This has, in a sense, been the main work. And Indians also chronicle their history very well at this period, but you have to go to some length to find it.
Sure.
I've been using a lot of Persian sources. I work very closely with an amazing translator of 18th century Indian Persian called Bruce Whannell.
Uh-huh.
And we've gone together to libraries such as Tonk, Rampur, Patna,
mm-hmm.
and have been digging out these remarkable accounts written at the time by Indian authors, which are every bit as graphic and as observant as anything written by the British, but which have largely remained untranslated. And it's that richness of these accounts which has, I think, led to the success of this book. People have been amazed by the... particularly there's one author called Ghulam Hussein Khan, who's a fabulous chronicler, and he reads rather like Edward Said. He's an analyzer of imperialism and an analyzer of colonialism, but writing not in 1970, but writing in 1780. And he is the first Indian to really think through what all this means, not just the simple, fact of a battle lost and a change of regime, but what it means for the whole classes who had fought in the Mughal cavalry, for the sort of people who painted miniatures, or the poets, the bards, all the different craftsmen.
Yes.
And he realizes the effects of the drain of wealth, with the British sending their money home rather than building monuments in India.
Mm-hmm.
He's an incredibly sophisticated observer. I mean, he understands as early as 1780 what this all means, the full import of colonialism.
Wow.
I think it's a miracle, in fact, that his work is not better known, because he's an incredibly important witness to all this.
Absolutely. So how long did it take you to write this book?
So this was a long slog. It took 6 years immediately, but it's been drawing on... I mean, I've actually been writing about the East India Company with previous books, such as White Mogul.
Yes.
Last Mughal, since about 1998. So this is drawing on 20 odd years of work.
Wow, amazing. And tell me, do you think that the East India Company in any way is a prototype for some of today's multinationals?
Absolutely. That's one of the big messages of the book, is that the company is not only the first major international corporation to span the seas, but it's... also, the founder of many of the things that we find most worrying about corporations today. It's, for example, the East India Company is the first company that really indulges in corporate lobbying of government to extend its monopoly and to extend its powers. It's also the first company that's caught bribing politicians. It actually offers share options to members of parliament as early as 1690.
Wow.
So all the stuff that we think of as very contemporary issues, do we worry about, for example, the level of support that a company like Reliance could give to one party or another? What are the pro quid quos that they expect in return for these large sums of money? This is a matter in any democracy, in Washington or in London, as much as in India.
Right.
But clearly, in a fragile democracy and one with less money, a single major corporation can obviously have a huge amount of influence.
Sure.
And so this sort of thing, which we think of as, very modern problems, actually has its roots back here in the East India Company of the 18th century.
Great. Now tell me, would you ever write on India's present era, the Modi era?
I have written on contemporary Indian politics, but to be honest, these days one has to be a little bit careful what one writes. I think there's far more... twitchiness on the part of the current government than there has been in the past. I think I'm safer probably writing about the 18th century.
Right. So we wish you all the best and all the success for your latest book and what will come forth from you. Thank you so much. Look forward to seeing you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Pleasure. Bye-bye.
ऐसी ही और कहानियाँ सुनना चाहते हैं? Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, Spotify या फिर जहां आप podcast सुनते हैं, वहां हम हैं।